Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. We are now into the second year of the Trump administration, and the last year has been filled with ups and downs, important victories, successful holding campaigns, and painful defeats. We've learned a lot, but there's always more to learn and more to be done. In this now weekly series, we talk with organizers, agitators, and educators, not only about how to resist, but how to build a better world. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
I'm Jane McAlevey. I'm an organizer and occasionally an author and sometimes a scholar. And I'm super happy to be here talking to you.
I am very happy to have you here. And everybody should read both of your books, Raising Expectations and tell us about the more recent one.
Quick, no shortcuts.
No shortcuts.
Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age.
Organizing, not mobilizing.
Correct, organizing.
Okay, we'll get back to organizing versus mobilizing. But first, big picture, what is the best thing you can say about the labor movement under Trump? What is giving you hope right now, Jane?
Yeah, that there's actually been a series of strikes more than even the sort of feeble inattention to strikes that the media gives to strikes, even though we know that they've been covering several recently, which is terrific. There's actually even more than even people know about because they've gotten kind of zero coverage or close to zero coverage, and they're actually happening. And so I am rather obsessed at the idea, and have been for, you know, most of my lifetime, that strikes are a very particular form of protest, that they matter much more than what we think of as casual sort of, or even good militant kind of protest. And I'm excited to see them happening under Trump.
Yeah.
And I'm disturbed at the lack of attention that they generally get. Mm-hmm. And I'm definitely ongoingly concerned, like, in terms of understanding what we need to do, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, this may not be a good thing, but I feel that since Trump's election, my own patience for things that come out of the liberal elite's mouths when they write or speak or say something in public, I'm becoming increasingly less patient with the whole idea of sort of the role that liberals play. Which, you know, if you're drawing a line in our movement, whenever we get to electoral politics, many of us do wind up in conversation with a lot of liberals, right, in important elections.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in some ways, I mean, it'd be good if they were coming to our side, but so it isn't like we can avoid them. I feel, though, that my own patience is far less than it was before Trump, because I think it's amazing to me that liberals largely still don't understand why Trump won. And that comes back to your question, which is what excites me. And I am incredibly excited that there continue to be strikes. Like, that was true even before the West Virginia education strike. Most people don't know about the strikes that I've been writing a little bit about and paying attention to that have been happening. They've been more in the healthcare sector, and people have been winning them, so we can talk about a few of them. People have been winning them, and they've gotten virtually no attention. But to me, it continues to reinforce sort of a core argument that I tried to make in No Shortcuts, I tried to effectively make in No Shortcuts, which is, again, that strikes are a very particular form of protest, and they're unique in their ability to generate the kind of power that the working class needs. So if you fast forward, I'm on fire with excitement and joy at the moment because of what just happened in West Virginia, which is a strike that people can't ignore and was absolutely freaking incredible, to use my most doctoral dissertation thesis language. Just absolutely, completely, and I can't curse, you know, because that won't help, but like, if I could, I'd say so many explicatives, but it was just an extraordinary strike at so many levels, and I'm not, so people paid attention to it, but I'm hoping that everyone pays as much attention to other strikes that are both happening and have recently happened, like strikes under Trump. So that's the form of the resistance that I've been paying most attention to, and that I still remain most hopeful about. And a piece that I was working on this morning is me essentially doing a comparative. This, I'm sure it'll be quite controversial, but I do a comparison. I'm doing a comparison between the protests in Madison, Occupy Wall Street, Chicago Teachers Union, West Virginia.
Ooh.
And I'm essentially looking at outcomes, and I'm comparing and contrasting what supermajority strikes mean, right? I talk a lot, in No Shortcuts, I talk a lot about supermajorities, and that structure-based organizing allows for something called supermajority, like that you can assess whether or not a super majority of the people who are involved in your struggle are actually engaged, right? Yeah. And that was a big argument that I tried to make in No Shortcuts. I don't know if you have this. Sometimes I have remorse that I felt like I pushed the Oxford to put the book out very quickly. And it's since the book is out that I feel like I get better and better about explaining some of the concepts.
You know, that's always how that works.
That I like first put that in the book. Yeah. You know, and so anyway, I'm trying to sort of articulate again. Like the value of structure-based organizing. It has limits too, by the way. Yeah. And I'm not suggesting that all sorts of other interesting things, all sorts of interesting protests don't matter. Right. I do think they matter. Yeah. It's just that I definitely think a supermajority strike, mm-hmm. which I think we've only seen evidence of it ever happening, really, inside of structure-based workplaces, mm-hmm. that I think they hold a very specific kind of power that's essential to resistance, to building a real resistance, yeah. a resistance that has more power than what I think so far is sort of a fun, feel-good, a lot of marches, a lot of statements. I'm interested in what's going to work, and I'm terrified that we have entered serious authoritarianism already, and that it may be getting considerably worse. And part of why I think West Virginia was so particularly important is because they took on a trifecta red, meaning the governor, the Senate, the House, right, which we have in a lot of states right now. They actually effectively mounted a super victory against a trifecta red power structure at the state level. And they did it in the public sector, quote unquote. Right. Mind you, I don't agree that there is a private public sector, but most people think that there is. And so for the moment, I'll talk about that, even though in my view, there's just one big economy.
Yeah.
And the right wing has created this fiction called the public sector and the private sector. I always have to say that because I really deeply believe it. Yeah. But and it's important in this discussion because even in the pages of The Nation and a few other places, I have been debating some men, I think, always in the movement, about the important differences between public and private sector. Like, that's a thing in the progressive movement, which I find frustrating. So what's important about West Virginia is it was done in the quote-unquote public sector.
Right.
It was done against a Republican governor, a Republican Senate, and a Republican House. There were three decision makers on the side of the employers that had to be defeated, and they defeated all three, which are the three I just named, to essentially get to ratification.
Right.
They had to have three Republican-controlled by pretty big majorities in the case of the Senate and the House,
right.
and then a governor who, was a Democrat when they endorsed him. We should all acknowledge that, though,
He trumped.
He trumped. Well said. So, I think there are so many aspects of that give us the kind of insight that I'm hopeful about and campaigning for in general in the movement, which is that we need more strikes, and we need way more strikes, and we need what I call real strikes, which are supermajority strikes.
Right. Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about that, the mobilization versus organizing, because we've seen a lot of marches. This weekend is going to be the March for Our Lives. There were the walkouts, and then there was the march.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about what organizing means in sort of contrast to these big periodic mobilizations.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And by the way, I'm super excited about everything that's coming out of Parkland.
Mm-hmm.
I think that young, very young people, the younger they are, have always played a really important and special and unique role in sort of capturing the imagination of a larger swath of society than the rest of us do.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of why they're having so much success, in addition to the fact that every time I listen to one of their leaders, I'm like,
Theater kids. They're smart.
Theater kids. They're amazing.
More
anyway.
Theater kids. The revolution.
God, totally amazing. So, but I think, part of what, and by the way, I've been to plenty of big march since Trump won, right? I love big marches.
Oh, my God.
Put on your marching clothes and go and scream and shout and make fun placards and climb up buildings. And, I am the first to sign up and go to every big march and small and big marches, right? They're great. I love direct actions. It's fine. But they are greatly limited compared to what I think of as deep organizing. And so to me, what organizing means is that you're expanding the universe of people from right. who we can mobilize.
Right.
You're actually expanding the base of people who we can then turn out for the Women's March or for climate marches or for, right. Let's get rid of guns in our society marches. Right. And that's the core difference. Mobilization, and by the way, West Virginia could challenge a little bit of what I say, and I'm trying to be critical about, self-critical and reflective on it, because it might be interesting to come back to that, like mobilization versus organizing in the context of that particular strike, because I think they did both particularly well, but it was maybe even more mobilizing than organizing at one level, not at all of them. But so organizing to me in general means we are expanding the base of people from whom we then get to put in our Twitter feeds, social media feeds, and get out to either the polls, right, either to vote, one form of very important mobilization, or to huge marches or to huge direct action. So mobilizing is essentially talking to folks who are already with us.
Right.
They're already converted. They're already somewhat with whatever us loosely means.
Right.
And that's great. And I think the problem is, as an absolute number, that number, the percentage of people in our society has been shrinking over the last 40 to 45 years as a percentage of our society, of people who self-identify as sort of progressive and who we can therefore tap to come out to big mobilizations. And I think that when it comes, so to me, organizing has been sort of the life obsession. It's the obsession I try to outline in No Shortcuts. And it's what I think union organizing does, not uniquely, but nearly uniquely.
Yeah.
Faith-based organizing, I think, has always stood to have a high capacity to do base expansion as well.
Good. We should come back and talk about
that. Yeah, for sure. So like faith, I think faith-based organizing, because it's structure-based, and because you start with a bunch of people who come in for one reason, and you have sort of, you know, they're in relationship to each other, and so having a protracted conversation with them to help them themselves come to an awareness that something's really deeply wrong, I think that also lends itself to serious base expansion. I think we saw that in the civil rights movement in this country, right? Using the framework of the Black Church was a particularly powerful mechanism for building the only other seriously powerful movement we've had, I think, in this country, besides the labor movement, which is the civil rights movement. So I still think both are possible. But the slight difference is one of them doesn't involve having to debate questions of faith, right? It's the boss. It's the boss, and you're trying to help people understand that the root cause of the crisis in their lives
is the boss.
It's the boss. It's their employer. Whereas we get into much more complicated debates about root causes and ultimate solutions when we get into faith-based organizing.
True.
So, but I'm still a huge fan. You know, progressive faith-based organizing to me matters a lot.
Yeah.
But nothing actually is more important than organizing in the trade union sector and with a sub-emphasis on structure-based organizing.
And Trump is a really big boss.
So explain for people who are not familiar, what does structure-based organizing mean?
Yeah, what it means is that it's hospitals and schools, for sake of argument.
Yeah.
It means that there's a defined structure, that there are a set of people who come to work every day, in the case of the workplace or, you know, church or synagogue or something, right? Like, but it means that there's a bounded structure of some kind that has that puts like a circle or a square or something around a defined number of people.
Yeah.
So in the West Virginia strike, for sake of argument, you had schools in 55 counties.
Yeah.
And if you were going to take a strike vote or if you were doing something leading up to a strike vote, you could very quickly assess, because the number of teachers is defined, let's just use 100.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's 100 teachers in a middle school
somewhere
in a county in West Virginia.
Right.
And so if you're a mobilizer or an organizer, when you're trying to understand, do we have a supermajority of people with us in this movement, in this mobilization we're attempting? Do we have a supermajority with us? You're going to do something called a structure test, and we should come back to that too, like the specific definition I use about structure tests, which means you're testing within a defined structure to see, do you have a majority, which means 51% in the lowest threshold for a majority. But I use the word supermajorities because, in fact, supermajorities is what it takes to win strikes, not simple majorities.
Yeah.
So a simple majority might win a union election. It's not going to win a strike.
Yeah.
And it's really different. So to win something really significant, like a contract after a worker's by simple majority maybe right. win an election
right.
or a card count, it's going to take an even bigger, by order of magnitude, number of people, which is a supermajority, to actually win a successful contract, to have a successful strike threat. Because yeah. in this country, it's 90% out or more to actually defeat a very powerful boss. So structure-based really means there's a defined number of people. Mm-hmm. In academia, they would call that a bounded constituency. And I think that sounds really complicated. So yeah. just means there's 100 workers yeah. in a school. If I take a strike vote, there's two things I'm measuring. One, did 100% of 100 people actually turn out for that vote?
Yeah.
That's one measure of your strength. Because
yeah.
if only 40 people showed up out of 100 teachers, and out of that 40, 35 vote to strike,
yeah.
that's a failed structure test for an organizer. So there's two things that are important about structure tests and structure-based organizing. One is you know how many are participating, and then how many agree with you. And you actually have to measure both.
Right.
Like, in any strike I've ever participated in,
yeah.
either as an organizer, a leader, or whatever it was, those are the kind of measurements that we're looking for. Mm-hmm. And I certainly spent a lot of time analyzing them in No Shortcuts, particularly in the chapter on the Chicago Teachers Union and yeah. how many structure tests they were doing leading up to whether or not they knew they had the numbers, the capacity to actually defeat the, at the time, super powerful Rahm Emanuel, who they systematically took down for us in yeah. terms of his power. That was a yeah. good thing. So that's what I mean by structure-based.
Yeah. Okay. Which is interesting because I was talking to somebody else about the Parkland-related things and saying, like, the thing that was actually much more striking, to me.
Such a good word.
Then the big march is the student walkouts.
Absolutely.
Which are basically a strike.
Absolutely.
And to see that
Absolutely.
Within this sort of framework of a structure
yes.
that, you know, you had to get a certain amount of kids in yes. each of these schools to actually walk out, to actually gum up the works.
Yes. And so in the school, so it's a really good example, and I saw the number million, that a million students walked out.
Yeah, that's
now,
amazing.
That's a badass number.
That's amazing.
That's as big as the Women's March,
yeah.
right? I mean, that's a million people is a super impressive number.
Yeah.
The thing, though, is for me,
yeah.
if I was actually going to be organizing in that sector, you know,
yeah.
which I'm not, I would want to know school by school
mm-hmm. yeah.
how many schools had a simple majority walkout,
mm-hmm.
how many had, because we use all these increments. So we'll go simple majority, if I'm organizing towards a strike,
yeah.
first threshold is, can we get to a simple majority
right.
on the first petition that says we think our boss is being unfair or
yeah.
we deserve to keep our pension or whatever the fight is.
Yeah.
And then we go to a 55% structure test. Then we build to 60, 65, 70, 75, 80, 85, 90.
Yeah.
Like that's the level of detail,
mm-hmm.
participation rate, and then approval rate
yeah.
that we're looking for in a real structure test. Before we know that we can win, and the difference between people who win collective action these days and those folks who unfortunately call strikes and don't win
mm-hmm.
usually
yeah.
is that they actually haven't done that methodical work, which is my fear about some of the hyped up discussion about what's happening in other states right now
yeah.
in the education sector. I'm actually super worried. I know you asked me before we started recording about that, so we can come back to that
yeah.
too. But the thing that excites me like crazy, and that just taught us a lesson again, is
yeah.
the value of supermajority strikes
mm-hmm.
in a structure-based context.
Yeah.
It's just, if we're trying to know how many people are with us,
yeah.
a structure-based environment allows you to meaningfully understand that better than any other kind of environment to organize in. And that's why I can sound, I think. I might sound more critical than I am, but I am critical of things like the fast food
yeah.
worker. I'm going to call them protests because
yeah.
that's what I'm doing in the article I'm writing right now. Like I'm actually re-clarifying that they're
yeah.
not strikes.
Yeah.
That a strike is something that shutters production. A strike actually shutters production
yeah.
Or causes a significant crisis. Like in the healthcare sector, we don't shut down the hospital because
right.
people would die.
Right.
But if the employer has to pay a double payroll and
yeah.
replace the entire workforce
mm-hmm.
with another not cheap workforce, like
right.
no less than $100 an hour for a low, you know, anyone who's a scab in a hospital strike,
yeah.
the janitor is going to get $100 an hour. Like there's super big money goes into
yeah.
scabs. So when an employer has to recreate an entire payroll, they actually can't sustain it for very long. So that's a serious crisis, right?
Yeah.
If you get 90% or more out,
yeah.
100% out, toast.
Yeah.
100% out with the community behind you, we win. And I think that's the exciting thing that we all get to pick up on if we pay attention to it coming out of West Virginia, yeah. is 100% out or a supermajority out yeah. with community support, we can defeat forces as powerful as Trump. That's the message of West Virginia.
And you said community support, which is a very important part of your first book, talking about whole worker organizing and organizing. You talk about the importance of organizing within the structure, but also of bringing in the community and the connections from the community to that structure. So that seems like also when we're talking about strikes in a political context, right, when we're talking about strikes as a weapon against a president, for instance, that seems like a really important part of the conversation.
Yeah, it's essential. And it's also back to why I'm obsessed about healthcare and education strikes. Mm-hmm. Is it's in part because I think that healthcare workers and education workers have a particularly unique ability to bring their entire community mm-hmm. into their struggle.
Yeah.
And so in West Virginia, it was definitely not that this is only, but yeah. it was definitely not only 34,000 workers, right. which is the number who struck between right. the teachers and the service personnel.
Right.
It was actually hundreds of thousands of people right. brought into the contestation for power
yeah.
against a very conservative power structure right. because the students went with them. Yeah. That factor in 100,000, 200,000, 222,700, I think, or 227,000. I forget the exact number, but I have it.
Yeah.
So you bring 220-something thousand students right. into the struggle with you. Nearly every student supports their teachers and education strikes, let alone, by the way, their bus drivers, their cooks, their janitors, mm-hmm. people
right,
who pick
exactly.
them up and drop them off, right? Like,
yeah.
they love those people.
Yeah.
I don't know. I either loved or hated, depending on who it was. I mostly loved my bus drivers. And I can still name them from junior high and high school for real because they were like amazing players in my life. One, because I was branded and had to sit in the bat anyway. So there were reasons why I became really close to my bus drivers and knew them all by name because I was forced by principals to sit in certain places on the bus.
Wow.
Yeah, because of walkouts.
Making trouble since
seventh grade. But who was counting?
And
yeah, sit in the front seat of the bus. So it went from cool kids sat in the back to cool kids sat in the front for uh-huh. the rest of school. And then we all loved our bus driver. But anyway, so I think that they really can. They can really bring the community into the struggle. And then when you think about it, I have not been able to find a number of parents. I have found a number of mm-hmm. students. In Chicago, it was so well reported on. Mm-hmm. That when I was writing their short, because I had the actual numbers of how many students and how many parents
yeah.
were in solidarity with them.
Yeah.
I was up against Rahm Emanuel's very intense campaign to divide them,
yeah.
Which was more effective, but obviously fell flat on its face, but more effective than Carmichael, the Senate president in West Virginia.
Yeah, he really...
he couldn't have gotten a single parent on his side, and obviously he didn't.
Yeah, and so, right, so when we are looking at these particular sectors...
Mission-driven and women!
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Women!
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 And
mission-driven.
And are the ones that are under attack right now, right?
And totally under attack.
This is
and
where...
And under attack from austerity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so
yeah.
austerity is... So the reason they're important is for so many reasons. One is because they can actually just win against stiff odds.
Yeah.
And two... As I think we're going to see play out in West Virginia, as I believe we will see play out in West Virginia, because of the structure of the PEIA task force,
right.
which
yeah.
is the health insurance task force, sort of like the ongoing piece of business,
right, yeah.
that the folks, that not just the teachers, that the education mm-hmm. workers in West Virginia have to carry their struggle
into.
The entire public sector who got a raise, thanks
yeah.
to the education sector. The entire next phase of the struggle
yeah.
is going to be 34,000 workers who went on strike, teachers and non-teachers in the schools, with a whole bunch more people that they brought into the
yeah.
struggle, certainly the state employees, but I think a few hundred thousand, to put it mildly,
yeah.
parents who came with them
right.
are now going to be demanding a tax of some kind, essentially retaxing corporations
mm-hmm.
to have a long-term funding solution to the health insurance crisis in West Virginia.
Yeah.
So what's interesting to me is that mostly men in our movement over the last 25 years
yeah.
have had a consistent line that the private sector matters more than the public sector, and that the private sector is the most important place that we have to do our work. Like, if we're going to rebuild the labor movement, it has to happen in the private sector. And not until we get the private sector numbers back up to something close to the public sector numbers, you know, can we win again.
Yeah.
And I have taken a sort of decidedly fairly public different position, which is one sector does not matter more than the other. And in fact, where I've been evolving to lately is that, if anything, the public sector matters more, not only because it's where we still have, until Janice,
well, we'll get
a majority of the membership of the labor movement, but it's actually also, and I do say this in their shortcuts, so I think it gets buried in the concluding chapter. Like, I argue that it's the mission-driven, largely female, often people of color, not always, but definitely mostly women, but who are also often people of color, certainly not in West Virginia, but elsewhere, who are the people who are suffering the consequences of austerity and who have the capacity to fight back because of those incredibly deep structured relationships they have with either their patients in the healthcare sector or their clients in the most sort of weird use of that word in the home care sort of part of the healthcare sector, but patients and people who they serve and take care of, or the students and the parents and the families in the case of education workers. So austerity is going after them.
Right.
The austerity front is around healthcare and education. Like, that's where massive cutbacks are happening.
Right. It's not happening to the cops. The cops are still getting whatever they want.
Damn right. Although it was the education workers who went on strike that got the cops from a 3% to a 5%.
Well,
and I'd like
cops,
to point that
Was it the cops or the state troopers or somebody else was originally in the 5% the first time around, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that was still because of the strike.
Well, yeah.
Very important to point out.
But it was they were the ones that were first thrown in while the rest of the...
By the right-wing Senate.
Yeah.
They were first thrown in by the right-wing Senate.
Yeah, and were carved out in Wisconsin.
Yes,
anyway.
Exactly. But it is for me, it's actually becoming... And this is true in England. This is true in other work I'm doing around the world, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is the same set of workers everywhere. So there's a huge struggle going on in England right now around the NHS, around saving the National Health Service, the NHS, which is the, shall we dare say, socialized healthcare system.
Why, yes, we
That's
shall. We shall.
Absolutely an incredibly effective and efficient system, so much more efficient than the American system.
Yeah.
The super privatized American ridiculous healthcare system. Not the workers, of course, but the capitalists making money off of us getting sick.
Yeah.
In England, the same struggle exists. They're trying to go after it. They're trying to privatize it. And the fight back is going to come really from the, mostly from the nurses.
Right.
Mostly from the female side. There's 280,000 registered nurses working for a single boss in England right now through the RCN, the Royal College of Nurses.
Yeah.
And you know, you saw strikes by junior doctors last year, mostly men, very smaller portion of them. It's a good example to me of like militancy without doing a power analysis. Sorry, guys. Like, it's going to take the women in the NHS to actually defend and save the system.
Yeah.
So, and they have the capacity to do it because everywhere in the world, nurses are highly trusted people.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere in the world, despite a multi, I don't know if we get past multi-million, but multi-million, from Waiting for Superman to like, right, there has been a multi-million dollar attempt to decimate the image of teachers.
Yeah.
And even though the pages of the New York Times occasionally will agree, or any other mainstream or liberal media outlet, ordinary parents in strike after strike choose to stand with their teachers.
Yeah.
Students stand with their teachers, no matter what, how many millions of dollars they try and use to degrade and attack and insult every educator and every healthcare worker. They haven't moved on nurses yet, right? But as I'm studying the attack on teachers, it's like, it doesn't matter how much money they waste, the relationship that's forged every day organically between mission-driven workers, workers who care deeply about their work, mostly female in the healthcare and education sector, is like an inseparable bond.
Yeah.
That's why it becomes organizing and not just mobilizing, because they're bringing hundreds of thousands of more people into the struggle with them and helping them understand who's to blame for the pain in their lives.
Yeah. I think I want to go from there and talk about the Poor People's Campaign, because this connects up with what we were talking about with faith-based organizing and trying to make something that started in North Carolina, right, with Moral Mondays, into a national movement that can tackle a bunch of different issues. So I wonder if you've been following... I guess, where do you think this is fitting into the landscape of quote-unquote resistance at this point?
Well, I'm excited by the Poor People's Campaign.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about it for some of the same reasons I was mentioning earlier, which is depending on how we think about, depending on how the Poor People's Campaign plays out, I'm excited about it because it's embedded in the faith-based world. Mm-hmm. Now, I think, and that's structure-based by definition.
Right.
So the question of how, you know, I think a lot of folks are getting excited about it too, and I think that that's very, very good. What I'm hopeful is that even though it may capture many people outside of the faith-based environment,
yeah.
which I think it has been, again, that's good. I'm hoping that inside of the Poor People's Movement, they keep the sort of dogged focus on having more of an organizing approach and less of a mobilizing approach, yeah. meaning that they're going to be counting how many congregations, how many synagogues, how many mosques, how many temples, how many churches, how many in
community
which sector,
yeah.
right, in which sector of faith we're talking about, how many members are involved, how many are taking action. Like, to me, that will be that'll be important as they continue forward. But I think, you know, it takes its origins from the Moral Mondays
right.
Movement, as you mentioned, and from Reverend Barber's work in North Carolina. And what I try to point out to people a lot about the name we know, many people know more now, which is Reverend Barber, which is great,
right.
Is that Reverend Barber's, one of his first, can't say the first, but one of his first most significant campaigns yep. that he was involved in before he became more of a household name yeah. among the progressive movement was the Smithfield Foods mm-hmm. campaign in North Carolina.
Which one can read about in your book.
Yeah, but who cares about that? Like, it's just such a, and I'm serious, yeah. like it's, yeah. it was such an important campaign.
Mm-hmm.
It was so, it was such a deeply, another deeply important structure-based fight.
Right.
And, you know, I interviewed him for the book because when I was interviewing the worker leaders mm-hmm. and the organizers connected to Smithfield, it was very clear that when Reverend Barber, a young Reverend Barber, in 2006,
yeah.
becomes elected as head of the state NAACP, now the NAACP is another interesting organization, right?
Right.
But like, so he becomes elected as a head of the state level NAACP, and one of his very first acts, because Reverend Barber has unassailably good politics,
yeah.
was to turn back a $10,000 annual check that Smithfield Foods used to give to the NAACP year after year.
Yeah.
And the old NAACP leadership
yeah.
that existed in North Carolina before Reverend Barber and a bunch of smart people decided, hey, let's take this institution back.
Yeah.
They had been happily accepting contributions from a not just union busting
yeah.
workplace, like a seriously sick, twisted, racist, evil corporate leadership at Smithfield Foods. You know, the NAACP there had been like happily accepting their checks
yeah.
For a bunch of years. Remember, Barber wins, and a bunch of people go to him, and he's already aware of it because he's working with faith-based leaders in the
right.
black community in North
right.
Carolina who helped him win office. And he's like, Smithfield, you know, don't we have a problem at Smithfield? Like, for their win, like, isn't there a problem at Smithfield? And they get in touch, and he famously rips up the check and sends it back to the Smithfield leadership and says, the old NAACP may have been accepting contributions, but we're not. And we're going to stand in solidarity with the workers. And so he becomes, along with several other important faith-based leaders in that state,
yeah.
A crucial player in sort of the end game at Smithfield Foods. And when I talked to him, he had already started Moral Mondays, just in the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
He had already begun doing Moral Mondays, and what made me so very pleased, this is back in probably 2014,
yeah.
when he starts Moral Mondays, I asked him, did he feel like there was an ongoing relationship between the 5,000 workers at Smithfield
yeah.
and the work at Moral Mondays? And he smiled and laughed and said, they send at least one bus every single Monday from Tar Heel, North Carolina to Moral Mondays. And he counts on the rank and file workers at Smithfield getting on buses to come to. So that was 2014.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think he has, as I said, unassailably good politics. He's been advancing them
yeah.
for as long as I've known his name, which is 2006.
Yeah.
And I think what he's trying to do right now is incredibly important.
Yeah.
And again, though, I hope the sort of methodical organizing on the faith-based side is happening as they're also creating a sort of an important mobilization vehicle for people.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think part of the reason why the faith-based community is so important in general and in the context of in solidarity with labor struggle is not just because most workers, you know, also go to a house of faith, but it's because they bring the ability to bring a critical, like a moral critique of out-of-control capitalism.
Yeah.
They can bring a moral, like they have moral authority to criticize a political and economic system in this country that's frankly immoral, amoral, rotten to the core.
Yeah.
And they can criticize it in some ways more effectively than union leaders can. Mm-hmm.
But we have to get to Janice, unfortunately.
That's okay.
I would like to pretend it wasn't going to happen, but unfortunately that has done nobody any good. So Janice is coming. It is almost certainly going to overturn the Abood case and make the public sector. I still don't have another word for right to work.
Yeah, or public sector.
Or public sector.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's going to screw over the unions of many, many hundreds of thousands, millions of people, many of whom are, most of whom are women.
Yeah.
And so what, again, I guess there's two parts to this question, right? What have people been doing that you've seen that has been good to sort of prepare for this, and what do you want to see more of?
Strikes!
Well, of course you want to see more strikes. But yeah. In particular,
yeah,
very...
No, but I'm also serious about, like...
Of course you are. I'm absolutely.
Yeah, but I mean, it's also, they're both effective to take on the power structure, but they're also, they've also, can be the most effective way to continue having the rank and file membership.
Oh, yeah. I mean, after West Virginia, people have signed up, many, many hundreds and hundreds of people are signing up as members.
I think it's thousands, but we don't have the numbers yet.
Yeah. I want those numbers.
I do too.
If anybody is listening to this and has those numbers, get them to us.
I don't think they have them yet.
I know.
I asked a couple of the branch leaders, and they're like, so it's at hundreds in just some of the counties, which is why I'm pretty confident it's going to be many more. So, so what's been effective? I think what's been most effective is the unions that, I mean, there's been sort of several different responses to it. One is no change of behavior. Okay, bye. They're in deep trouble.
Right.
And that's out there.
Yeah.
Then there's been the attempt since it was Friedrichs, right? Versus California teachers before.
And Harris B. Quinn before it was Friedrichs.
Oh, but that one they did approve. You know, I mean, Harris B. Quinn went through.
Yeah.
Sadly.
But they could have done the thing that they're going to do in Janus back then. I remember getting,
absolutely.
It was like in a car on the way to the airport when that one came down and going like, well, we dodged the big bullet, but we got hit with the small bullet.
Right, that's right. And that one came first, right? So it was like, we could have learned our lesson then. Then Friedrichs was coming. Okay, so, you know, several significant unions, certainly including AFSCME, certainly including SEIU, a whole bunch of it, CWA, you know, depending on the state and the sector, but several good, you know, better than average unions have been out there sort of recommitting from Harris v. Quinn on, like recommitting the idea that they have to really have an intentional plan.
Yeah.
But this is the problem, the actual word choice I'm going to use, that they have to have an intentional plan to actually sign up more members.
Right.
So the problem with that word is that's not about engaging people in a serious and significant way in the life of the union. So that's sort of like another reaction. And then I would say the very best reaction is where what organizations are coming to under unions are coming to learn that it's actually by engaging members and workers, not members, because we're usually not membership, right? It's by engaging the workforce, in participating in the very life of the organization, the day-to-day work of the union, politics in the union, opening up endorsement processes, opening up negotiation sessions. Like, it's by actually small d democratizing the union, focusing on increasing participation, that then the membership flows in and follows.
Yeah.
The strike being the highest level of it, but I'm going to argue there's two other ways that you can seriously involve the rank and file in the work, and that's through the endorsement process in most unions. And by the way, if most workers were participating, even in the 2016 cycle of who their unions endorsed, we probably would have Bernie Sanders and not Donald Trump. So there's a lot of reasons why union leaders should open up the endorsement process. But I'm going to argue another immediate one is that by showing the rank and file members that their opinion deeply matters, that's by involving them and inviting them into participation in important decisions like endorsements, and then also in important decisions like collective bargaining agreements and contracts, that the unions that are actually opening, like opening up the floodgates by small de-democratizing, by opening up and inviting genuine participation in the union, they will and are learning that that is actually how they're going to sustain the union organization in a post-Janus world. Strike should be sort of the third level of building, you know, what I think Rick Fantasia first labeled a culture of solidarity, what many of us talk about, though, like the kind of solidarity that gets built in a strike, which we certainly still see in Chicago, but it's 6 years after the initial strike now in 2018, as we're talking, compared to 2012. I'm not worried about the membership numbers in Chicago, and I'm not worried about what the membership numbers are going to be in West Virginia, and I'm not worried about what the membership number is going to be with the Massachusetts Nurses Association. Right. And I'm not worried about what the membership number is going to be in a whole bunch of unions that I can name, unfortunately, generally by name, because in fact, they have open endorsement processes. They have open negotiations processes. Yeah. They actually genuinely see the union as the rank and file. Those unions are going to survive, and the more unions that quickly adapt to a small d democracy model in the union are actually going to do fine. The problem is most aren't moving to that right now. And so am I nervous? Absolutely. Yeah. I think the most immediate effect is going to be on political donations to the parties. That's the most immediate effect, is going to be a significant draining of the coffers in terms of how much money we have. And much as I, disagree with most of how unions do most of their endorsements, the fact of the matter is they still matter. Yeah. And the fact is resources and money matters in our elections right now. I don't think that they matter as much as we think they do, or as much as contemporary people often theorize they do, but they damn well do matter. When you have the capacity to hire folks, when you can put them out there, when you can have them convert from rank and file volunteerism to like doing nothing all day long from morning till sleeping at night, because you have capacity to pay them to help drive other members out in campaigns, that actually matters a lot. But I will also say that it, even thinking about elections in a post-Janus world, comes back to the need to seriously revive the strike. There's two important things to say about Janus, which probably eat up the end of our lovely chat together time-wise. One of them is our political system. This is not a new idea, what I'm about to say, by the way. The political system is completely broken, right? I mean, with three major Supreme Court rulings, there is no way that we're competing, even if Janus didn't happen, even if trade union money stayed at the current level. The system is fully corrupted at this point and completely broken, between voter suppression, between the amount of money that the Mercers and the Cokes and company can dump into to owning the airwaves. That only undergirds the reason why we're going to have to be able to create a crisis in the economic arena. I don't think we can take down not just Trump, but the forces behind Trump, which is more important to me than Trump, because he's going to take himself down at some point. He's going to do 20,000 illegal
Stormy
things,
Daniels,
you know?
Is going to do it for
him. Like he's, you know, but the forces that put Trump in power and that will remain when his face gets out of all of ours, to take them down is going to require creating a crisis in the economic arena. The more economic concentration is in the hands of a handful of people, the more they control the political system, and the more we're going to be forced in this new gilded age back to a kind of warfare in the economic arena to take on the capitalist class. I think that's real. And the last thing I want to say, though, about Janus specifically is this. If you read a brief, it's in one of the briefs that came out of Yale. If you actually go ahead and read the briefs in Janus, which I don't recommend as light reading. Oh, my God.
No.
I don't pretend I read them all, but I did read a bunch. So, yeah. And if you listened, so I had, there were two people, unnamed, to protect them, in the room, who gave me very detailed notes about the actual conversation, the oral arguments that happened.
Yeah.
inside of the courtroom. And at some point, the transcript will come out, and we can all eventually read it. But right. I was getting sort of like, I had specific questions for some people who were going to be sitting in the audience to like take notes about. And where I believe they're going, and this is not in the movement dialogue or the analysis yet, where I believe they're really going with analogizing free speech, dues, union dues, instead of free speech, I think it's not even going to be about dues. If you read some of the briefs, and when we get to the transcripts from the debate on February 26th in the Supreme Court, where they're really going is to say that anything collective is a violation of free speech. They're actually arguing that collective bargaining, that the idea of collective is an infringement on free speech rights. And so it isn't, which basically means we're heading towards saying unions are illegal and an infringement of individual free speech rights. And I am, I haven't said this anywhere, so I'm happy to say it to you, but I actually think it's really significant that essentially the minute you get away from an individual worker sitting down to quote-unquote negotiate an individual worker's contract with their employer, the minute it becomes collective, where I think they're going, what they're doing in Janus, if they don't do it in Janus, because it may be too much of a leap, but I'm going to predict here with you that the next case they're setting up is literally going to say collective bargaining is an infringement on free speech rights, and they're heading towards banning collective bargaining in unions in America.
Well, on that cheery note,
but we can beat them!
We can beat them! That is the thing I probably quote you the most on, is saying, people are ready to fight. And that is always, they are. I mean, we are seeing that all over the place. Jane, how can people keep up with you and your work and find your books and all of those things?
Oh, jeepers creepers. Okay, I learned how to tweet. Okay, I haven't really learned how to tweet.
You have a Twitter.
No, I know. I still can't even load things properly. I'm trying, though.
You're
At RSGEXP, which is Raising Expectations. And then I have a website and I have a couple books.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Fayebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.